Good evening, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Cases from the Community. As tonight, our investigator panel will be discussing the role of antibody-drug conjugates in the management of triple-negative and HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. This is the first of three CME programs we're doing here at the San Antonio meeting. We've been coming here for more than 20 years, and we have a great faculty tonight. Dr. Priyanka Sharma is on her way over here. She just did a presentation at the meeting. We also have, from the far side of the stage, Professor Peter Schmid, Dr. Rita Nanda, and Professor Javier Cortez here today. As is the case in pretty much all of our meetings, we will be discussing the use of unapproved agents and regimens, so check out the package inserts of the various products for more information. It's really a thrill to be able to work with a general medical oncologist to prepare this meeting. These are the docs who work with us for the programs we did last week and tonight here at SABCS, and next week, who met with me individually to record videos. These are the faculty members we work with over these 10 days. Really an exciting time for us. Let's talk about ADCs in breast cancer. Of course, tomorrow night we'll be talking about T-DXd, particularly when we get into HER2-positive disease, but today we're talking about triple-negative and hormone receptor-positive disease. And here are the general medical oncologists who met with me to really kind of verbalize the questions they want to see discussed tonight. And you'll hear them verbalize that, but also, you know, I got their thoughts in general about what they would like to hear, what would be valuable to them. We really appreciate their input. So we're going to start out talking about a very important topic, particularly since the ASCO and then the ESMO meeting, upfront treatment of metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. In a second, Peter's going to give a talk. We're going to start out with some cases. And our first case is a patient of Dr. Favreau, an 82-year-old woman, multiple comorbidities. She's had an MI. She's had a couple strokes. She's an active smoker and does not want to quit smoking. She previously was treated for localized triple-negative breast cancer. Shortly thereafter, developed bone metastasis, as you'll hear. And then here's Dr. Favreau talking about his question to the faculty about what he should do in terms of first-line therapy. In this case, the PD-1 assay was still pending when I talked to him.
82-year-old female who is an active smoker, CAD, has had MIs in the past, has had strokes in the past, developed worsening neck pain and back pain. And on imaging, she has extensive bone-only metastatic disease in multiple areas of her spine and hip and pelvis that's painful. She's currently receiving some radiation therapy to her cervical spine. And the question is, you know, what would be a potential option for her? I'm cautious about her because of her age and her multiple medical problems. Her functional status is actually pretty good, but she's been smoking since she was a teenager, actually, and so she really is just kind of basically refusing to quit. So she continues to smoke. I don't think she would agree to or really tolerate chemotherapy, but you know, would there be a possibility of using a dose-reduced sacituzumab plus pembrolizumab for somebody like this? The questions that then come up with her are, with her active smoking status, we have to be careful about pneumonitis, which I think is definitely one of the most feared side effects of immunotherapy and antibody-drug conjugates.
So, Peter, I imagine you've seen a few people. It's all nice to put up a presentation of this theoretical scenario, but this is real life. Any thoughts about this situation?
Well, I think the first question we need to answer is, should PD-L1 positive or not? Because that will define your overall strategy. If the patient is PD-L1 negative, then it is a form of chemotherapy, targeted or non-targeted. And I think capecitabine, which wasn't given, is actually a very mild therapy. And in a patient with bone-only disease, you have a relatively low-risk situation. Of course, we can, and we will look at the data with ADCs in a minute. We know the ADCs are more effective, but are certainly not better tolerated than standard chemotherapy. So if we want to optimize the quality of life of this patient, we could possibly start with a mild chemotherapy and still use the ADCs on progression.
Interesting. So, Rita, what about the patient who's an active smoker in terms of the potential? Does that increase the risk of pneumonitis, or are you concerned about that? Also, what about this idea of using reduced-dose sacituzumab up front?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think those are great questions. I think it's not necessarily the case that, I mean, we don't see much ILD, right, with SASE, but with TDXD, obviously we do. I mean, this is a triple negative patient. We'd probably start with SASE over TDXD. But I don't think we have any data to suggest that patients who have COPD or smokers have a higher risk of ILD, but the concern is that they may already have some compromise, and if they develop ILD on top of that, then that's potentially the concern.
Or they may have something on their imaging before you even get started. It's going to make it a lot more complicated. So, Javier, if this patient's tumor turned out to be PD-L1 negative, now Peter's going to go through the new data we just saw at ESMO with datopotamab deruxtecan. We saw sacituzumab also in this setting. How would you think about it for a patient like this?
Well, first of all, I would like to maybe consider here that this is a patient with bone-only disease. I would like to see how much time the patient was on treatment with capecitabine, because maybe this is a like an androgen receptor positive with a luminalic feature. So not all triple negative breast cancer are the same. Having said that, if we consider like a classical triple negative breast cancer, I think that we could discuss, as Peter said, chemo or not chemo. But if I have to decide between sacituzumab and datopotamab, I think that both of them are very similar in terms of the progression-free survival, which was the primary endpoint of the trial for one of them, the co-primary for the other one. And I think that we have to consider three things here. The first one is the schedule, 3 weeks every 1 and 8 every 3 weeks. The second one is the common adverse events with one of them. SASI is more neutropenia and diarrhea, which are well managed if you know how to do it, always with G-CSF in this case. And with data, we have to take into account the eye disorders and basically the stomatitis. And that's all these aspects should be taken into account to discuss with the patient, but at the end, I would feel comfortable with any of them.
So when I first saw the ASCENT data, ASCENT 04 data at ASCO, first thing I thought about is, what about the patient who had a prior neoadjuvant therapy with an IO, and how are you going to make that decision? And that comes up here in this patient of Dr. Astral, a 74-year-old woman, a recurrent disease. She actually ER negative, HER2 low, also PIK3 mutated, although triple negative, PD-L1 positive. She has progression 18 months after getting 3 cycles of neoadjuvant, KEYNOTE-522, which was actually stopped because she developed a rash. She had a diverticular abscess that she had to be hospitalized for, and deep vein thrombosis. I see Dr. Priyanka Shank is showing up here. Hey, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you all. Sorry to be late.
No problem. We're good.
Speaking at the last session.
Yeah, awesome. So, so we're presenting some cases here, Priyanka, and this is from Dr. Astral.
I give a sassy pembro because I saw the ASCENT-04 data. I said, all right, let's try sacituzumab pembrolizumab. Now, I've had trouble getting insurance companies to approve this, but we were able to get approval in this case. So I gave her sassy pembro.
So I see she had pembro neoadjuvantly.
She had 3 doses of pembro. She seemed to be responding to the taxol carbo-pembro, and I just had to stop it because of toxicity. So could the faculty panel please address the role for pembro for patients who have had pembro or a checkpoint inhibitor in the neoadjuvant setting, if they, they progress and they have end up with metastatic disease, what do we do? Now, with the ASCENT-04 data, is it worth trying SASE pembro?
Any other questions for the faculty?
This has come up with me for several patients now. They're triple negative with a PIK3CA. Is there any data out there for using CAPI for a triple negative patient?
So, Rita, SASE pembro in a patient with prior IO, any thoughts? I'm sure you've already confronted that quite a few times.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've confronted it in the case where somebody's actually on their adjuvant pembro and recurred. This case, I think, is a little more easy. If this patient's PD-L1 positive, I'd certainly consider it. She only had a few doses. It sounds like she was responding to her chemo IO, and it was over a year and a half ago. So I think it's reasonable if she's PD-L1 positive to consider it here. I guess my concern is, though, with carbotaxol pembro, that she had a pretty tough time of that, and I guess that's more my concern necessarily than trying IO again.
So, Priyanka, any issues with combining SASE and pembro? It looked like the toxicity data was, kind of what you would expect. Synergy, but, a couple of people brought up to me, what happens if somebody gets diarrhea, which either of these agents could cause?
Yeah, so I think that's just patient education and our staff education in terms of the diarrhea. The SASE diarrhea is different. It's more like chemotherapy diarrhea. The IO diarrhea is more like tends to be bloody. They have a lot of abdominal cramping and pain. And then when in doubt, have a low threshold for further investigation because there sometimes there's no clear way of knowing one drug versus another.
Well, I think that the pembrolizumab, the diarrhea of pembrolizumab is usually not starting very, very early on time. And with sacituzumab, that's something that you can see from the very beginning. So I think that that's something that might help a little bit, at least.
What about this issue of PIK3 and triple negative, Javier? Have the PIK, you know, capivasertib, other PIK3 agents been used?
Well, we have two phase three trials now with AKT inhibitors in the first line setting. Both of them were negative for the primary endpoint, and even in patients with PIK3 mutations. So I think that maybe that's something interesting to explore in further clinical trials, but in the clinical practice today, I think that we do not have data good enough to support the use of these drugs.
All right, Peter, we've seen a lot of new data coming out. Let's take a look at it.
Yeah, if you just go through, just remind us where we actually started the journey with triple-negative breast cancer. Just a few years ago, we saw the median time to disease recurrence was about 18 to 24 months. Patients those days were on first-line therapy for about 3 months. Only about 3 out of 4 patients were well enough to get to second-line therapy, were on average on that treatment for just over 2 months. Only about half of the patients would be well enough to get to third-line therapy. So where we were just 6-7 years ago, median overall survival was around a year to 15 months. And we've come a long way. You are aware of the changes in the early disease setting with immunotherapy obviously playing a key role. In the metastatic setting, until last year, our standard of care in PD-L1-positive patients was chemotherapy and checkpoint inhibitor. PD-L1-negative patients, chemotherapy, and in BRCA-mutant patients, PARP inhibitor. And in the second and third-line setting, it's really where the ADCs played an important role. But the question is, can we move those ADCs into earlier lines? You all are aware how these ADCs work. We, with the next generation, with the third generation of ADCs, we have a slightly different mode of action than we initially thought of the first and second generation. So the drug is still binding to the surface, gets internalized, and the chemotherapy payload gets released inside the cell. But what we do see is that the chemotherapy drug can leave the cell and then lead to cell killing of immediately surrounding cells, which is called the bystander effect. And it's one of the reasons why those drugs now have superior activity to what we saw in the past. You're aware of the plethora of drugs being investigated in breast cancer. We have 3 licensed drugs, 2 of them targeting TROP2, 1 of them targeting HER2. Datopotamab deruxtecan and sacituzumab govitecan is what I'm going to be focusing on because those are the drugs where we have data now in the first-line setting. 3 trials to discuss, 1 in PD-L1-positive patients, 2 in PD-L1-negative patients. PD-L1-positive patients first, ASCENT-04 trial, first-line metastatic triple-negative breast cancer, chemotherapy and pembrolizumab versus sacituzumab govitecan and pembrolizumab. I think it's, again, always important to look a little bit at the details. Patient, obviously, PD-L1-positive, disease-free interval. So the time from the last chemotherapy to the start of this treatment was at least 6 months, and patients with stable and treated brain mets were allowed. Chemotherapy, as we would expect, if patients want to have pembrolizumab, a taxane or gemcitabine carboplatin. Primary endpoint, progression-free survival. Now, one point is really critical when we look at the trial data. And in this trial, the sponsor of the trial actually offered patients access to second-line sacituzumab govitecan. And if you look at the number of patients who crossed over, it was 81% of patients who had subsequent sacituzumab govitecan in the second- and third-line setting. And we know sacituzumab govitecan has about a 6-month survival benefit in that setting. So that's important when we look at the overall survival data. Looking at the trial population, a third of patients with de novo metastatic disease, 18%, 6 to 12 months disease-free interval. A small group of patients had prior immune checkpoint inhibitors, only 4%, so this didn't really affect the trial data. If you look at the primary endpoint, a significant, in my opinion, meaningful improvement, hazard ratio 0.65, median pushed up by about 3.5 months, and that is pretty consistent across all subgroups. If you look at the at this point in time, immature overall survival analysis, so only 26% of the data we require for this had occurred. We don't see a clear overall survival benefit, hazard ratio 0.89. It's too early. but also we need to consider 81% of patients received sacituzumab at a later stage. If you look at the duration of response on the right side, you can see that is a quite impressive improvement from 9 to 16 months. The overall response rates are relatively similar, slightly better with sacituzumab govitecan, 60% versus 53% chemotherapy and pembrolizumab. In terms of the safety, I would say there wasn't really a new signal. If you look at the dose discontinuation of the drug, actually fewer patients discontinued the treatment, 12% with sacituzumab compared to chemotherapy, 31%, and dose reductions, again, slightly less with sacituzumab compared to pembrolizumab. Safety profile very much in keeping with what we know, and Javier will talk about safety management with ADCs, which I think is a really important point. If you move to now PD-L1 negative disease, standard of care is chemotherapy, and here we have two trials, TROPION-Breast02, trial with Dato-DXd, TROP2 target ADC, and that was randomized compared to treatment of physician's choice, taxane in most patients and patients with a disease-free interval of more than 12 months, or ribulin or carboplatin and capecitabine as options in patients with a shorter disease-free interval. Now, key differences in this trial, any disease-free interval was allowed. So this trial allowed patients who could have relapsed a week after their initial therapy, and in fact about 15% of patients here were early relapsers between 0 and 6 months, and I think that's really critically important, especially as we're increasingly treating patients with the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. We have those few patients who do relapse tend to relapse earlier. The trial has two endpoints, primary endpoints, progression-free survival and overall survival, and no crossover was offered. And in many of the countries where patients were treated, sacituzumab govitecan was not available at progression. If you look at the data presented, only about 42% of patients received sacituzumab govitecan at a later line of therapy. And I think that's what we need to consider when we look at the outcome data. Progression-free survival, impressive, meaningful, significant improvement. Hazard ratio 0.57. The delta, just over 4 months, from 5.6 to 10.8 months. 72% of patients at this point in time went on to receive second-line therapy, and I think that's something we need to discuss that's really important. The rate of patients who are not able to get second-line therapy is usually around a quarter to up to 30%, and that's what we saw here as well, and that may drive our choices, what we use in a first-line setting. The benefit for progression-free survival seems to be pretty consistent across all subgroups, but what was really exciting to see was an overall survival benefit. We see a hazard ratio of 0.79. We see a 5 month delta at this time point. And it appears to be consistent across most subgroups, with the exception of one subgroup I want to highlight in patients treated in US, Canada, and Europe. That doesn't seem to be, obviously these are small groups, a clear survival benefit. And this may be down to sacituzumab govitecan as crossover therapy more available in those patients. And again, I think important to consider that. If you look at the overall safety data, again, very positive for the ADC. Discontinuation rate 4% compared to 7% of patients with standard chemotherapy. And if you look at the tox profile, of course, each ADC has a distinct profile. Here with that Dato-DXd, we have less myelosuppression. We have less diarrhea than we saw earlier with sacituzumab govitecan. But we have more dry eye, and we have more mucositis, and we can talk about with Javi how we best manage this going forward. Now, if we look at treatment-related, again, here a little bit more broken down, side effects, oral stomatitis, you can see this is in about 50% of patients grade 1 and 2 and about 8% of patients grade 3. There are prophylaxis strategies with oral steroids, but we need to discuss how well they work. The ILD rate is relatively low compared to, for example, trastuzumab deruxtecan. If you look at the third trial, again, that's the second trial in PD-L1 negative patients, this time with sacituzumab govitecan called ASCENT-03 trial. Very, very similar to the trial I shared with you, but there are a couple of distinct differences. One difference is that patients had to have at least 6 months disease-free interval, so that's very early relapses were not included. And similar to the ASCENT-04 trial, patients were offered crossover And we can see that 82% of patients receive crossover to sacituzumab govitecan. It looks similar in terms of the early relapses, but we have 0% 0 to 6 months, and 6 to 12 months, 20% of patients. Some patients were PD-L1 positive, but that was only less than 1%, and the prior treatment with immune checkpoint inhibitors, again, was only around 4%. Interesting, I didn't point it out in the other trial, but it was very, very similar there. If you look at prior treatment, so neoadjuvant therapy, because these are obviously first-line studies, capecitabine only used in around 19%, platinum only in around 20%, similar for the DATO trial. What it suggests is these patients are less heavily pretreated to what we see now in our clinical practice. And I think that's important because we see patients now with more refractory tumors where I personally think the benefit from those ADCs is even more so than it is in patients with slightly more sensitive disease. So keep that in mind when we look at those data and discuss them. Primary endpoint, progression-free survival, significant meaningful improvement, hazard ratio of 0.62, very similar. The median, 6.9 to 9.7. Here, 64% of patients were able to cross over to second-line therapy. 40% are still on first-line treatment. So again, I would expect around a third of patients are not able to make it, unfortunately, to second-line treatment. Benefit consistent across all subgroups. Now, if you look at the response data, objective response rate 48%, 46%, a little bit lower with what we saw for DATO DXD. But interesting, the duration of response almost identical, 12.2 months versus 7.2 months in the control arm. Overall survival at this point in time is immature, and so there's only a descriptive analysis, hazard ratio of 0.98. But if you look at progression-free survival too, so this is the time from beginning of the first-line treatment until the failure of the second-line treatment, it does seem to be that this benefit is carried over with a 4 months delta, 14 to 18.2 months, hazard ratio of 0.7. If you look at the exposure and safety summary, again, where I was focusing is leading to discontinuation. The discontinuation rate remarkably low at 4% compared to 12% with chemotherapy. Again, almost identical what we saw with DATO DXD, which shows that if we know what we are doing with a bit of experience, these ADCs can be given in a very safe way. And the safety profile is very much in keeping with what we know from sacituzumab govitecan. We see a slightly higher degree of neutropenia and gastrointestinal toxicity in terms of diarrhea. But this is something we again will discuss with Javi. We have learned how to manage it. You will see here at the meeting patient-reported outcome data. And the bottom line is this is a group of patients who is already very well with limited disease-related symptoms. So we are not improving them. But because we delay progression, and progression is linked with new symptoms, ultimately patients have probably a longer and a better maintained quality of life over time. So if I put the two PD-L1 negative trials next to each other, and obviously not to do a cross-trial comparison, but just for us to understand the data a little bit better, the key differences between the trials, you see this in the top level is the Tropion, the DATO DXD trial, had patients with very short disease-free interval, 15% of patients. There's clearly a difference in crossover, 42% to 82% to sacituzumab. Both trials had about a third of patients were not able to have second-line therapy. PFS hazard ratio 0.62, 0.57, very, very similar. 12 months progression-free survival rate, very similar. Where we do see a difference is a higher response rate with DATO DXD compared to sacituzumab govitecan. The rate of primary progression, very similar. The duration of response, very similar, 12.2, 12.3 months. The overall survival rates in 1 year, identical with 75%. So we see two drugs that have very encouraging data, clearly improve outcome, and we can discuss how we best use this. Just for completion, putting ASCENT 04, the PD-L1 positive trial, in here as well. Again, the data match very, very well and are consistent across all groups. Now, is there possibly a role for immune checkpoint inhibitors in PD-L1 negative patients? This is data we generated with DATO DXD, the same ADC, in combination with the immune checkpoint inhibitor first line, but most of the patients were PD-L1 negative. And if you look at the response rate, 79%,
progression-free survival 13.8, median duration of response 15.5. We have just updated and they're now at 17 months median duration of response, so that is a very powerful signal. And there are ongoing trials that look into this. Diamond and Trofuse are both trials in PD-L1 negative patients that look into the combination of Dato-DXd or sacituzumab tiramitican, so an ADC in combination with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, and I look forward to seeing how this might pan out. Final point is, what's the best sequence for ADCs? Should everyone now have an ADC in the first-line setting? And the jury is, to some degree, still out. If you just look at the data, if ADCs are given in first-line setting, you see your delta in progression-free survival. Second line, we are limited in, well, at least the registrational studies are allowed to use ADCs. If you look at the third-line ADC data, you see a relatively similar delta. So actually, if you were just putting this next to each other, you may come up to a similar time patient's disease is controlled. Where I see a fundamental difference is the response rates. ADCs have higher response rates. If you have high disease burden, if you have a tumor that shows some sign of refraction, it is important to push this back. We can have a positive impact on quality of life, but we also need to consider whether patients are well enough to get to second-line therapy, and if we have in a third of patients only one option to treat those patients, we may choose the most effective therapy. So that's what I wanted to share. I look forward to discussing this. Thank you.
Awesome, Peter. So we're getting some great questions from the audience. Your point about the PD-1 negative is very interesting. There are a number of solid tumors where PD-1 is not predictive of benefit, so I wouldn't be surprised we see something there. But Priyanka, one of the questions we got is, what time from Keynote to treatment until metastatic disease would you be comfortable going back to an IO, for example, Sassy Pembro? How long?
So I think the time frame that I'm looking for is 12 months for patients to be away from Pembro. That includes their adjuvant Pembro, where I would feel comfortable going back on it. The 6 to 12 is debatable. It depends on, many factors. But under 6 months, I'm just not sure that reintroducing Pembro is helpful, although if we're bringing it with an ADC as opposed to chemo, one could conceptualize that they're synergistic. So I wouldn't take that option away from the patient, but my expectation of how well it will work will be lowered.
So we're going to go on to some cases here. This is a patient of Dr. Iannucci, an 80-year-old woman, multi-regimen, recurrent, ER-positive HER2-low. We're talking about ADCs now with ER-positive HER2-low or zero disease. She was HER2-low. She had actually already gotten hormonal therapy and capecitabine, and Dr. Iannucci was wondering what to do next in this elderly woman.
Her next treatment was capecitabine. She did well with that for maybe 6 months. Again, had disease progression with hepatic and osseous metastatic disease. And at this time, she was willing to try intravenous chemotherapy, and that's when we started on sacituzumab govitecan. She has had an amazing radiographic response. Her tumor markers have declined. Her PET scan has showed significant regression in all of her osseous metastatic disease, lymphadenopathy, as well as her hepatic metastases. And she continues on sacituzumab at the present time with stable disease. So my questions to the faculty about this case is, would anyone have done something different as far as your first-line chemotherapy? How do you decide when we have available to us the sacituzumab govitecan as well as the Dato-DXd? I have not used the Dato-DXd yet.
How did she do on the sacituzumab?
I actually did not have to do any dose reductions.
So, Rita, management use of ADCs and ER-positive disease got a lot more complicated last January here in the United States when Dato got approved. So this patient was HER2-low, so obviously you have the option of T-DXd. So how are you thinking about sequencing in a patient with HER2-low ER-positive and HER2-0, if there are any HER2-0s left?
I have a tendency to start with T-DXd for these patients who are hormone receptor positive, HER2-low based on DESTINY-Breast04 And so I think, you know, it's interesting that she started with SASE, but I probably would have started with TDXD.
So, Javier, interesting question from the audience. We actually had a case that we presented at a webinar like this, a patient in visceral crisis, where you, in a situation where you typically would use an ADC, whether, let's say, TROP2 or TDXD, are you comfortable using it when a patient with visceral crisis compared to chemotherapy? Any reason chemo would be better in that situation?
Well, I think that we have to differentiate here between HER2-low, ultra-low, and HER2-0. I think that we do not have data at all, to the best of my knowledge, to suggest that ADC in the first line is superior to chemotherapy. We will see the data of the ASCEND-07, but we know from the press release that progression-free survival was not B-positive. So in the HER2-low and ultra-low space, we clearly know that Trastuzumab deruxtecan is superior to chemotherapy in both PFS, probably survival, let's see, but also overall response rate. So clearly, I would suggest TDXD first.
So, Peter, kind of putting aside regulatory issues, theoretically, how would you decide between sacituzumab and dato?
I think it's always a difficult decision. I think for me, a lot of this is based around tolerability, the safety profile, but also patient preferences. It's one is a three-weekly treatment, the other one is day 1 and 8. It has some impact. One has a shorter infusion time, DATA-DXD, so shorter time on the chair. But ultimately, the key decision factor here is, for me, is side effect profile. We are quite good now at managing, actually, the myelosuppression with prophylactic G-CSF. We're quite good at managing the diarrhea, preventing that associated with SG. We are learning how to manage the stomatitis better with DATA-DXD. So I think it is something, there isn't a clear answer. One is better than the other, in my opinion. It's subtle things in a discussion with patients where we work out, should we choose drug A or drug B?
So Priyanka, Drs. Gupta and Ma have some questions about DATA-DXD. Dr. Gupta has a patient who has already gotten a TDXD and now is thinking about what's next. Dr. Ma, interestingly, Peter, she actually had a patient on a trial of Durva and Dato who did really well. And actually, it turns out she's used a lot of Dato, even though she's in community-based practice, and she had some thoughts as well.
I have a patient who is hormone receptor positive, HER2-low, metastatic breast cancer. She has now failed multiple lines of treatment. My question is, would there be a role of giving datopotamab deruxtecan to this patient? She's hormone receptor positive. She has liver mets and bone mets, a little bit symptomatic, excellent performance status. My question is, after a patient has received TXD, is there a role of giving datopotamab deruxtecan because they have the same payload? Or even if the patient had not received TXD and had just received sacituzumab, would there be a role of giving Dato-DXD? What I have at least read is that Dato-DXD has some unique toxicities. You know, they do recommend that they need to have eye examination and use some eye drops. Any pearls about that? And I think stomatitis is another thing that they may have, mouth ulcers. So are we using dexamethasone mouth rinses prophylactically or only if they develop oral ulcerations? Or anything else that they would like to have a medical oncologist know about the toxicity and management of toxicity from Dato-DXD?
Have you used Dato and any other patients or just this one?
Oh, yeah. We now have a new adjuvant trial with Dato, the triple negative. We use quite a bit. Mucositis has some, not a major problem. We do preemptively give everybody steroid mouthwash these days. Sometimes we tell them to ice chips in their mouth during infusion. So I do think it's a severe problem for some patients, but mostly manageable. She did not have any eye issues during treatment. I'm curious what the expert panel think between these two TROP2 targeted agents, you know, how they choose in their personal practice, what's their preference? Based on side effect profile, or they believe there's an efficacy difference? What's their preference?
I should mention, you see Dr. Gupta in different clothes there because I talked to her twice. I talk to these people all the time, you know, every day it seems like. So Priyanka, any thoughts about, first of all, toxicity with Dato and also sequencing? If you have somebody who's gotten TDXD, would you go to an ADC next in general? And would you be comfortable going to from TDXD to Dato with the same payload?
So we're now seeing more and more real-world and institutional data that is telling us the second ADC doesn't work, whichever comes second, like however you sequence it. And there's some data that suggests that if you intervene with a chemotherapy in between, that the second ADC might work. This is all retrospective. So if I'm in a bind, which often you are when you get to this kind of a state, you've exhausted many options, that I try to put a chemotherapy in between if they haven't had eribulin or navalbine or gemcarbo or gemcitabine, or even Doxil, I put that in between the next ADC. In terms of the toxicity management, I agree, like with Dato-DXd, prophylactic steroid mouthwash is very helpful. Ice chips during infusion is very helpful. Also important to counsel patients about the mouthwash, like if they don't have mucositis within the first few weeks, they'll stop using it. So that's important. The eye drops are important to prevent the dry eyes and the contact lens issues.
So Rita, where do you see ILD related to Dato? Like we put TDXD over here and the other million things that cause ILD that we use every day, is Dato closer to here or closer to TDXD? Is it actually increased or is it not so much as, and also how do you manage it? Do you manage ILD if you happen to get it on another drug the same way you manage it with TDXD?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in the studies. I find it so fascinating that you've got the same payload as TDXD, but just very different side effect profile, right? And it's all, you know, driven by the antibody and the antigen target. So there is not as much ILD with Dato as we've seen with TDXD, so it's more like SASE than TDXD. But I think the management for ILD across the board, you know, pneumonitis is are steroids.
Yeah, I guess we can talk about rechallenge. We're going to talk a lot about that tomorrow. We actually have a case of rechallenge tomorrow. All right, Priyanka, let's talk about this increasingly complicated question of post-endocrine treatment and the use of ADCs.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about ADCs and endocrine-resistant hormone-positive metastatic breast cancer in two buckets, the TROP2-directed and the HER2-directed, just like Peter did for TNBC. So when we talk about TROP2-directed ADCs in hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, we have three candidates, two approved, one with a positive phase 3 trial. All of these have TOPO1 inhibitor payload. They all have bystander effect. Sacituzumab and sac-TMT have higher drug-to-antibody ratio compared to Dato-DXd. All three of them, different dosing schedules. Sacituzumab is 2 weeks on, 1 week off in a three-week cycle. Dato is every 3 weeks, and sac-TMT is in between a two-week dosing. So the first trial we'll talk about is TROPiCS-02, which was a phase 3 trial of sacituzumab, govitecan, and hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer. This trial required patients to have at least two, but not more than four lines of chemotherapy to be eligible, and all patients were required to have a CDK4 inhibitor prior to their chemotherapy. And this trial enrolled 543 patients, and the primary endpoint was PFS by Bicker. If you look at the patient demographics, we see a large proportion of patients, almost all of them, 95% had visceral disease, about 25% had de novo metastatic breast cancer, and median lines of prior chemotherapy before coming on the trial was three for this. So it was a very heavily pretreated patient population. Looking at the results, median PFS was statistically improved with sacituzumab compared to treatment of physician's choice by a delta of 1.5 months. And median overall survival was also statistically improved with sacituzumab compared to treatment of physician's choice by a delta of 3.3 months. The objective response rate was 21% with SASI versus quite low with chemotherapy of physician's choice. When we look at efficacy by a line of number of lines of prior chemotherapy, similar efficacy was seen regardless of prior lines of chemotherapy, less than two versus over three. So in 2023, FDA approved sacituzumab govitecan for patients with metastatic hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative breast cancer who have received endocrine-based therapy and at least two additional systemic therapies in the metastatic setting. The next study is TROPION-Breast01, which had similar design to the TROPICS. Patients were randomized to receive Dato-DXd versus chemotherapy of physician's choice. This trial enrolled a less heavily pretreated patient population. Patients were required to have at least one, but no more than two lines of prior chemotherapy for metastatic disease. CDK4/6 inhibitor use was not required, although a large proportion of patients had received it. The trial had dual primary endpoint of PFS and OS. The baseline characteristics of this study, prior lines of chemotherapy, 63% of patients had received two lines of chemotherapy, and I think the median was about one in one of the reports. 83% of patients had received prior CDK4/6 inhibitor. These are the results. Median progression-free survival was statistically improved and with a delta of 2 months. And the overall survival was a dual primary endpoint. We saw that at ESMO special release earlier this year, and there was no different in overall survival between the two arms. The median overall survival is around 18 months in both arms. A quarter of patients in the chemotherapy of physician's choice received an ADC after study therapy versus only 12% in Dato-DXd arm. Again, this trial did not allow mandatory crossover with provision of ADC after progression in the TPC arm. As you mentioned earlier, in January of this year, FDA approved Dato-DXd for treatment of patients with metastatic hormone receptor-positive breast cancer who have received prior endocrine therapy and chemotherapy for metastatic disease. I'll briefly discuss the OptiTROP trial because I know Dr. Nanda will cover this later. This is the third TROP2 ADC, and this is trial for hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer patients. These patients could have received 1 to 4 lines of prior chemotherapy and prior CDK4/6 inhibitor, again randomized to receive either sac-TMT or chemotherapy of physician's choice. And just briefly, the basic demographics, about less than half the patients had received one line of prior chemotherapy and others had received more treatment. The PFS was statistically improved in the sac-TMT arm compared to the chemotherapy arm with a delta of 4.2 months. And the overall survival at the time of reporting was descriptive because of a lack of maturity of data, but you can see the curves separating. Again, this trial did not mandate a crossover to the ADC after progression in the chemotherapy arm. The objective response rate was robust at 41%. The trials that we just discussed were later line trials, although these patients had had prior chemotherapy for metastatic disease, some trials more heavily pretreated patient population, some trials a little less heavily pretreated population. So we do have first line trials of ADC compared to chemotherapy in hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative metastatic breast cancer. And these are the TROP2 ADC trials, ASCENT-07, which we will see results from tomorrow at this meeting. This trial compared sacituzumab for treatment of physician's choice in first-line setting, and the TROFUSE-010 trial that is comparing chemotherapy of physician's choice versus sac-TMT versus sac-TMT plus immunotherapy. TROFUSE is still enrolling. So this is the press release from ASCENT-07 that suggests that the trial did not meet its primary endpoint of PFS. Overall survival was not mature. However, an early trend was seen. We wait to see more detailed results tomorrow. So TROP2-directed ADC in metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, these ADCs are generally better than chemotherapy of physician's choice in the pretreated metastatic setting. So patients that have had anywhere from 1 to 4 lines of prior chemotherapy, SG and Dato-DXd are both FDA approved in the United States for overlapping clinical scenarios, and we just saw the clinical questions pertaining to that dilemma. These ADCs differ in their administrative schedule and toxicities, and how we choose one or the other is highly dependent on discussion with the patient, their baseline comorbidities, what administration schedule works for them, and what toxicities concern them the most. We're awaiting results from the first-line ADC trials. Moving on to the HER2-targeted ADC in this space, so this is just how we define HER2-low breast cancer. HER2-low is about 60% of all hormone-positive breast cancer, and this new ultra-low category is about 20 to 25% of all hormone-positive breast cancer, which is defined by faint, incomplete membrane staining in less than 10% of tumor cells. So this is traditionally was IHC0. Now we have this this new category of ultra-low. DESTINY-Breast01 was the landmark trial that established the efficacy of HER2-targeted ADC in HER2-low metastatic breast cancer. This trial enrolled patients who had received endocrine therapy and 1 to 2 prior chemotherapy for metastatic disease, randomized patients to receive chemotherapy versus T-DXd, enrolled mainly patients with hormone receptor-positive disease, 480 patients, and a small number of patients with hormone receptor negative, that is the triple negative breast cancer, 60 patients. So if we look at the updated analysis at the median follow-up of 32 months, the progression-free survival was statistically significant and clinically significantly prolonged in the T-DXd arm compared to chemotherapy arm with a delta of 5.4 months. And overall survival was also improved with a delta of 6.3 months. The objective response rate was quite robust at 52.6%. With the longer follow-up, no new toxicity signals were seen. The rates of ILD remained unchanged compared to previous analysis. DESTINY-Breast06 is the first-line trial that looked at T-DXd versus chemotherapy of physician's choice in patients who had received prior endocrine therapy. And HER2 testing was centrally done for this trial and also for DESTINY-Breast04, central HER2 testing. This trial enrolled patients with HER2-low disease and also enrolled a smaller cohort of patients with HER2 ultra-low disease, a little over 150 patients. So the ultra-low patients comprised 17% of the trial population. 30% had de novo breast cancer. 86% of patients had visceral disease and only 3% had bone-only disease. So this is slightly different than what we typically think of our first-line chemotherapy population for hormone receptor-positive disease, and almost 90% had prior CDK4/6 inhibitors. So when we look at the PFS, T-DXd improved PFS over chemotherapy of physician's choice, both in HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low, with similar delta, 5.1 months in HER2-low and 4.9 months in ultra-low. The objective response rate was quite robust in both low and ultra-low groups. If you look at subgroup analysis, T-DXd appeared to be superior to chemotherapy of physician's choice in all analyzed subgroups. OS analysis is still is not mature, but you can see some early separation of the curves. One important aspect for this study is not many patients got T-DXd in second-line setting, and we already know from DB04 that T-DXd improves survival in second-line setting, so this obviously has to be taken into account when we look at the overall survival from this trial. A true crossover design trial will be the only way to tell us whether T-DXd up front or second-line is the best strategy for overall survival. So first line or later, T-DXd first line or later after endocrine therapy. We already had the approval of T-DXd in second line, and in earlier this year, FDA approved T-DXd for first line for patients with HER2-low and ultra-low. Notably, FDA approved this with a companion diagnostics for ultra-low, although none of us use that specific companion diagnostic. We just use whatever we do in our own pathology labs. So for HER2-low and ultra-low metastatic breast cancer, T-DXd is as first cytotoxic therapy or chemotherapy as first cytotoxic therapy are both reasonable options. And the disease burden, sites of metastatic disease, patient preference, and performance status drive these decisions for us. This is simple but somewhat complicated algorithm that we use for deciding how to choose different treatments. And the first line is kind of based on HER2-low or ultra-low. But even for low and ultra-low, single-agent chemotherapy is a reasonable first-line option for the appropriate patients. And from then, you move on to second-line and third-line. And we have the available ADCs to use. But I have this caveat there that ADC post ADC efficacy is very limited. So although the arrows are going, they're kind of dashed. And we need more data to inform clinical practice in that space.
Thanks, Priyanka. This is simple but somewhat complicated. It's like my life.
Yes.
So, Javi, you know, we get great questions from the audience, things I never think about. a number of people asking about TROP2 ADCs and CNS activity. Tomorrow night in our HER2 program, we have Nancy Lin from Dana-Farber, done a lot of work on brain mets. What do we know about CNS activity of the TROP2 ADCs, Javier? Another interesting question is, do you see a difference in PD-1 assays, whether it's a primary or metastatic site?
So in the ASCEND study, the primary endpoint was in patients with no CNS metastasis, but in the intention to treat, there were patients with stable brain metastasis, and the activity was exactly the same. We do not have, at least I have not seen data for a patient with unstable brain metastasis. And there is some real-world evidence showing that it seems to work very similarly for those patients with no brain metastasis, but we don't have a big group of patients treated prospectively with unstable brain metastasis. And the second question about PD-1.
PD-1 in the primary versus MET.
Well, I think that, so it depends where we are going to test PD-L1. So if in the metastatic site is the liver metastasis, we might expect less expression of PD-L1, but if we are going to the lung or maybe to the lymph nodes, it's similar to the primary tissue. So what is very clear is that wherever the PD-L1 expression is positive, we should go for immune checkpoint inhibitors.
So we're going to move on now and talk about ADCs in recurrent triple-negative breast cancer, and Rita's going to go through the data, but first we have a couple of cases. Dr. Gupta has a 73-year-old woman with a ER-negative HER2-low disease who actually gets sacituzumab first, does really well, and then Dr. Chen, who has another patient on sacituzumab, has some questions about it.
She developed a biopsy-proven liver metastasis. Her S142 testing was positive, so we gave her nab-paclitaxel and atezolizumab, which she got for 4 months, had progression of disease, and then I gave her sacituzumab. I have had to dose reduce sacituzumab, but she went into complete remission from sacituzumab. We got 2 or 3 years out of that. She had a complete response to liver metastasis, so what is about her case that she responded so well? And I wanted to know if anybody does that 1 week on, 1 week off with the sacituzumab that did make the treatment very tolerable. I have not had much problems with sacituzumab, to be very honest.
How did she do on the sacituzumab in terms of her counts?
Her counts were not a problem at all.
We have had some experience with the sacituzumab, but in general, our experience is that patients have had a fairly good response with the treatment. I think the challenge has been the neutropenia, you know, that's associated with this treatment. You know, so I think patients, you know, we have used growth factors. In some patients, I have done a 1 week on, 1 week off. So I'll be interested in terms of the faculties, what they recommend in terms of side effect management for sacituzumab.
So, Peter, of course, we have really interesting data with different levels of HER2 and TDXD. We see this patient that Dr. Gupta has who had a really great response to sacituzumab. But what do we know about TROP2 expression and benefit? There is an assay that was done in lung cancer, which seems to be, I think, predictive more of data, a cytoplasmic nuclear assay. What about in breast cancer? Any correlation with TROP2 expression, Peter?
So there's some data out there. The bottom line is, regardless of the TROP2 expression, the ADC is still better than chemotherapy. But within the different groups, high versus low TROP2 expression, there's clearly more activity in patients who have higher TROP2 expression. And I think in the future, at the moment we don't do this, but in the future we may have to think about if you have a patient with very low TROP2 expression and higher HER2 expression or vice versa, which of the ADC strategies we prefer. Because we have learned that you really have one good shot on goal with your ADC strategy. The second ADC with the same payload doesn't work that well. So I think it doesn't matter when we compare to chemotherapy, but we want to compare one ADC with the other. I think the expression may make a difference.
So Rita, you're going to go through the data on toxicity with sacituzumab, but there's a trial, as you're going to talk about, looking at preemptive antidiarrheals and growth factors. Do you use either one of those strategies in your practice?
Yeah, you know, I do not. Generally, I do not do primary prophylaxis with growth factor. I think we are using it earlier and earlier these days. And so in heavily pretreated patients who've struggled with cytopenias, then absolutely, I think it's something to consider. But I generally wait until the first cycle and use therapy based on how patients do.
So we're going to another case. This is a 69-year-old woman with ER negative HER2 low. Also, a HER2 mutation. I forgot to ask you all a question about that in the faculty room, so I'm going to have to ask you something. I don't have no idea how you're going to answer it. But this patient developed grade 1 ILD. We have a case tomorrow night, same thing, and question to rechallenge. And then also we have some other questions about TDXD and HER2 low. Here it is.
She started with capecitabine for 10 months, progression of disease. We had sacituzumab that was approved at that time, so I gave that to her. We got about 13 months with that. And then when we had the presentation for TXD in the HER2 low, she was my first patient. Right after the ASCO presentation and approval, I started her on TXD. I got her first PET scan, complete FTG response, complete.
Wow.
I could not believe it, Neil, when we saw that complete response. So we continued that, and then she developed grade 1 ILD from TXD. So I stopped it. Her ILD did not resolve in 4 weeks, so I had to wait about 6 or 7 weeks. We did serial scans. I gave her steroids, restarted the TXD. She did tolerate it fairly well, but then had progression of disease. Now she has extensive skin mets, you know, peritoneal mets, hydronephrosis from that, a pelvic mass. I just repeated the NGS recently. Again, the ERBB2 mutation is present. She still has excellent performance status. She has no symptoms, I mean, even though she has so much disease and she's really wanting to remain treatment focused.
In terms of management of potential pneumonitis, especially with TDXD, I would love to hear from the faculty what their current approach is in terms of assessing for pneumonitis, perhaps monitoring. One thing I use a lot to help with chemotherapy-associated diarrhea is, if it's not controlled with loperamide, is to actually introduce cholestipol, and I found that to be helpful for many people. What other strategies have you found to be helpful?
So, Priyanka, any comments about these questions about pneumonitis with TDXD or any other ADC, and what about rechallenge for grade 1?
I mean, the grade ones that recover with steroids, and there's data that you can rechallenge with a lower dose, and, you know, over 80% of the patients with that rechallenge and can continue to stay on that dose, and I've personally done that. But if it doesn't resolve, then that makes you a bit concerned. You also have to look for other causes, right? There's just patients can get a viral infection and other things. And if the patient is willing to take the risk, maybe reintroduce it with an early scan at 3 weeks and 6 weeks to assess this. If they're really out of options and they're in visceral crisis and still have that HER2 mutation, right? So you have a targeted agent.
So speaking of HER2 mutation, this is the question I meant to ask you before we got started here. So Peter, you know, we've been talking about HER2 mutant lung cancer for a while. TDXD works very well there. It's actually used first line a lot. Recently, we did a program with Dr. Haymock, John Haymock from MD Anderson, and he told me about HER2 TKD mutant lung cancer that now responds to TKIs, just like kind of like osimertinib and alectinib. There's one called zongertinib that was just approved, another one just approved, sebevertinib. You know, do we know whether that occurs? I know you see HER2 mutation. I didn't know about it at the time we talked to her. But do you see TKD mutations or these new TKIs, something that might be used? Dr. Haymock said, yeah, you know, it should be pan-tumor.
Yeah, so we see this in about 2 to 4% of breast cancer. We see HER2 mutations. We have small studies, phase 2 non-randomized studies, that show that HER2 TKIs, for example, neratinib, can show some tumor response. But it's interesting to look at this in the context of giving TDXD, which is obviously a HER2-targeted form of chemotherapy, and whether patients who had already had TDXD, if they have a HER2 mutation, still benefit from a HER2 TKI, I think that's unclear at this point.
Yeah, but these, like, you know, I've heard about neratinib for HER2 mutations, but these new TKIs, you look at their waterfall plot, it looks like osimertinib in EGFR-positive disease. So I don't know if it would work in breast cancer.
So we haven't looked at the next generation of TKIs, just at the older ones.
All right, so we're going to move on now, and Rita, let's talk a little bit about sequencing of therapy in triple-negative disease.
Yeah. well, this is the problem with going third. We've already answered everything. This is just a refresher, so I'm going to go pretty quick so we can have some more great questions. But obviously, ASCENT, you know, is an older study now, and this was what led to the approval of sacituzumab govitecan, I'm just going to call it SG for short, for patients with triple-negative breast cancer. This was a trial that enrolled patients who'd had two prior lines of therapy for triple-negative breast cancer. One could have been in the early stage setting if patients had recurred within a year of completion of early stage therapy. And what you can see here that we've known for some time was a significant improvement in median PFS as well as overall survival. And it's interesting, the study wasn't even powered to detect the overall survival advantage. That's how good this therapy was. And for those of us who take care of a large number of triple-negative breast cancer patients, this was just truly game-changing for us. I mean, I have had a patient who was on ASCENT and remained on therapy for 4 years after. And so we got our first approval for our first ADC, a TROP2-targeting ADC, based on ASCENT. And we've had some follow-up data now, longer-term survival data. Again, we're continuing to see that significant improvement in median PFS and OS in the overall intent-to-treat population in a more recent update that was published last year. Again, 3-month improvement in median PFS, more than 5-month improvement in overall survival, which is pretty exciting. And Dr. Schmidt had alluded to this, these data a little bit earlier, about TROP2 expression levels and efficacy of SG. SG is better than chemotherapy of physician's choice, regardless of TROP2 expression levels. But using an H score, which is a range of 0 to 300, looking at percent staining as well as the intensity of staining, you can see in the upper left hand there, you know, we still see SG doing better than chemo, but maybe not as robustly working as well, you know, in this patient population as compared to those who have more moderate or high levels of TROP2 expression. So I think it's really provocative to think about, you know, maybe we need to be doing HER2 low and TROP2, because we do know, and I'm going to show you some of that data, that we never get as much bang for the buck out of the second ADC that we give. And so I think it's really interesting to think about that. When we think about some of the side effects, and I know Dr. Cortez is going to go through a lot of toxicity management, again, you know, this TROP2 targeting ADC has a topoisomerase 1 payload. SN38, which is the active metabolite of irinotecan, is the toxic payload here. So as we would expect, we see what we see with irinotecan. We see cytopenias, neutropenia, and diarrhea. But generally, it's better than we see with irinotecan. So it's generally pretty manageable, either with antidiarrheal agents, growth factor, and or dose modifications. Moving on very quickly to talk about TDXD, so our HER2-targeting ADC in patients with hormone receptor-negative disease who had HER2-low disease from the DESTINY-Breast04 trial. If you'll recall, about 10% of patients who participated in DESTINY-Breast04 had hormone receptor-negative HER2-low disease. So this exploratory analysis showed us a numerical improvement in median PFS, a little over 5 months, and an almost 10-month numerical improvement in overall survival. So it was 58 patients, right? So it was a small number, but the results that we saw here were really in line with the intent to treat and the hormone receptor positive patients. So when that approval for TDXD and HER2-low disease came through, it also encompassed hormone receptor negative disease. And we saw an update that was published a little bit earlier this year, a few months ago, of the DESTINY-Breast04 trial in hormone receptor negative HER2-low disease, and you can see we're continuing to see that benefit of TDXD over chemotherapy of physician's choice. When we look at survival, again, you know, really impressive 10-month improvement in median overall survival. Again, you know, numerical improvement. We are not able to assess for statistical significance given the small numbers. And then I did want to just briefly mention the DAISY trial, which looked at three different cohorts of patients, those with HER2-positive disease, those with HER2 low disease and HER2-0 disease. And on the far right hand here, you can see that there were patients with HER2-0 disease who seemed to benefit from TDXD. Now the PFS was lower here, the response rates were lower here. And I guess that raises the question, you know, these HER2 IHC assays were really developed to identify those patients who have high levels of HER2 expression, right? So they don't perform as well at those low levels of expression. Is there a minimum? You know, I've heard people say the patient has HER2 ultra-low disease or ultra-low disease. You know, what is that cut point for T-DXd efficacy, or do we even really need to check? And there are trials that are ongoing looking to address that question for us. You've already seen the datopotamab deruxtecan frontline data, very impressive improvement in median PFS as well as a survival advantage, although, you know, not as much crossover to another TROP2 targeting ADC. But we saw in these heavily pretreated patients a 32% response rate, and you know, the majority of these patients, about 60% or so, had a prior topoisomerase 1 inhibitor type of therapy. So again, you know, we saw some promising efficacy here, and that's already been moved up into the frontline setting. We also heard a little bit about sac-TMT, right? We got three aromatase inhibitors, we have three CDK4/6 inhibitors, and now we've got three TROP2 targeting ADCs and even more coming down the line. This was a large randomized phase 3 study predominantly done in Asia that looked at sac-TMT versus chemotherapy of physician's choice. And similar to what we've seen with ASCENT and with Dato as well, a significant improvement in median PFS as well as OS. So again, this sac-TMT is not approved in the U.S., but there are trials ongoing in TNBC and hormone receptor positive disease, as you saw Dr. Sharma mention briefly. A lot of interest, obviously, in thinking about what are the mechanisms of resistance to ADCs. It was really interesting to hear Dr. Gupta talk about that patient who had a really nice response to T-DXd after SG. And so you kind of wonder if that's a patient who maybe was resistant, you know, kind of had antigen resistance as opposed to payload resistance, because both of those therapies have topoisomerase 1 payloads. But we're just now starting to think about what are the different mechanisms. This is very simplified, but we think about resistance to the payload, and the approved ADCs we've got are all topoisomerase 1 payload ADCs, or resistance to the target. So here in this cartoon, in the case of SG, is that ADC unable to bind to the antigen and then not be internalized and have the linker cleaved and then exert its effect. So lots of different things to think about. We're starting to see small series of studies in patients who've been exposed to topoisomerase 1 ADCs, and we're trying to understand better what the different mechanisms of resistance are. We can see mutations in ctDNA and TOP1, as well as variants in TOP1 that lead to resistance to topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload ADCs. And then in this rapid autopsy series on the right, in patients who've had prior SG, it's interesting, not only is there some payload resistance, but there's also some antigen resistance. So I just wonder if that patient that Dr. Gupta talked about maybe was more of a antigen resistant patient as opposed to a payload. Although, you know, I think we don't know, but it's really interesting to see. As we've talked about, there are a number of real-world experience studies that have looked at ADC after ADC. All of the trials that led to the approval, obviously, were done in parallel, so patients who got, you know, SASE hadn't had T-DXd or T-DXd hadn't had SASE. But what we're seeing in our real-world data sets is that second ADC we generally do not get very much mileage out of. And so it really, you know, in these cases where in triple-negative breast cancer, a lot of times, you know, in real-world data sets, 50% of patients don't go on to get a second line of therapy. You really do want to put your best foot forward and get the best ADC out there. And again, here are some other studies that have looked at sequential use of ADCs, really showing, with an occasional exception, very little efficacy for that second ADC. This was a retrospective data that looked at the Flatiron Registry data. Dr. Tarantino and colleagues had published over 600 patients who had SG immediately after T-DXd, and you can see that basically all of these patients were progressing on that first scan that you do after you start SG, so basically progressing within 3 months of therapy. There are a number of prospective trials that are being done to help us better understand how to sequence these ADCs. We've got a trial, the TRADE-DXD trial, which is a TBCRC trial, as well as an ENCORE registry trial ongoing within the TBCRC. TRADE-DXD is looking at TDXD after Dato and Dato after TDXD in both hormone receptor positive as well as hormone receptor negative disease. I think that will be really interesting. Serial biopsies, serial ctDNA assays, I think it will be really informative. And then the series study, which is looking at SG after progression on TDXD. Obviously, we've got a lot to look forward to. There is just an explosion of antibody drug conjugates out there being developed. We're looking at novel antigens. We're looking at new payloads. I think we all would agree that we need different payloads. There are MMAE payloads, but a whole host of other payloads that are being investigated. And I think it's a lot more exciting to think about sequencing ADCs when we've got a different payload to deliver to these patients. Obviously, a lot of work needs to be done on understanding mechanisms of resistance, though, to further inform this work. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Rita. So I think we could do a whole extra hour here just on the questions I'm getting, Javier, but here are a couple for you. Putting aside reimbursement issues, can you envision a situation where you would want to use TDXD and somebody was HER2 zero? And also, what about ER negative HER2 low, which wasn't in the HER2 low study?
Well, I think TDXD for HER2 zero, I would like to check if it is HER2 null or HER2 ultra low to decide. HER2 null, definitely waiting the results of Destiny-Breast15, I would not use it, but for HER2 ultra low, for sure. Regarding ER low, for me, and when you look at the biology, it's very similar to triple negative breast cancer. I would consider ER low as triple negative, except for the antibody drug conjugate. For me, in the triple negative breast cancer setting, I prefer to use acetuzumab govitecan based on the phase 3 trials. In the ER low, maybe I would go for a TDXD if HER2 low.
Pick another one. Would you use Dato DXD if a patient previously had grade 1 pneumonitis from TDXD?
Sure. Yeah. So I think that, as you said before, any of you, I think that pneumonitis is quite frequent, not quite frequent, but typical from TDXD, but it's not so frequent in anti-TROP2 antibody drug conjugate, so I would feel quite comfortable with that.
Here, another couple of questions from the audience. Priyanka, this is never thought of this one. Has anyone encountered problematic weight gain with Dex rinses despite not swallowing? This occurred in a patient I managed with Dato, gained 25 pounds. Another question is, any comments on the treatment algorithm for, they call it nearly triple negative breast cancer, so ER 11 to 20%, grade 3, HER2 0, PR 0. Is that triple negative or ER low?
So if you brought it down from 11 to 10, we would all call it true triple negative. But I mean, I would treat that person, especially since they have HER2 zero disease, use my TNBC algorithm and place the TROP2 ADCs first. The weight gain from Dex, so that's new to me, and you just should ensure the patient isn't swallowing it. The patients do things that we sometimes just don't think about. We haven't seen that in the everolimus studies, like the previous studies, so this would be unique.
Yeah, well, you can see if they have other steroid, you know, hyperactivity, et cetera, whether they have other symptoms.
I mean, the endocrinopathies are not reported but definitely look for thyroid issues if weight gain is going on.
All right, well, I've got a kind of simple but maybe not that simple question I'm going to ask Peter to address in a minute, which is to answer Dr. Hussein's question of exactly what do you do to prepare a patient in terms of acute GI toxicity who's about to start TDXD. I'll say one thing about TDXD now with the pan-tumor approval that, you know, now this is an issue in GU oncology, GYN oncology, and it's interesting when you look at the people who used TDXD, you have the breast cancer investigators, and general medical oncologists, a lot of experience, very familiar with the emetogenic effect of TDXD. But once we get to the other group, not necessarily. Actually, we had, Priyanka, we had you. I did a video with you that I showed at the ASCO GU meeting because I couldn't find a GU investigator who had much experience with T-DXd, so we actually showed what you had to say. We did another program for AUA, and we showed Hope Rugo there too, because again, they hadn't used it as well. But anyhow, let's get back to Dr. Hussein, who's got a 42-year-old woman, multi-regimen, recurrent, progressive, ER-positive, HER2-low metastatic breast cancer. She's about to start T-DXd, but in prior chemotherapy, she had severe nausea. Here's Dr. Hussein and his questions about this.
42-year-old woman. I have been treating her for 7 years, multiple regimens. It's time for me to start trastuzumab deruxtecan. And she has had, with other prior chemotherapy, severe nausea and vomiting. More nausea than vomiting, but that's bothersome to her. So my real question here is, what drugs do you use prophylactically with cycle one, that you will not wait until you use them in a reaction way, but you use them prophylactically? Do you use 2 drug or 3 drug? If you want to use the 3 drugs, would you add something else prophylactically, like the atypical antipsychotic olanzapine? If you use olanzapine, do you use it the night before or the morning of? For how long? What dose do you use? Have you had any pushback from patients knowing that you are giving them and this something called atypical antipsychotic drug? And what about the role of the neurokinin inhibitors? Would you use those before olanzapine or with olanzapine? Actually, most people don't vomit the same day or the day after. It's actually very rare. They vomit usually 2 to 3 days.
You said she's had problems before with nausea and vomiting?
She had actually nausea. It's actually way more bothersome to patients. Both are bothersome, nausea and vomiting. But nausea, because it stays with you. I mean, the vomiting, and I'm not trying to belittle the importance of it. You know, you vomit a few minutes, you drink some water, ginger ale, and you do okay. But to be nauseous all the time, it's really bothersome.
So, Peter, this is like a cognitive test. Can you remember all the questions he asked? But maybe we can just simplify by saying exactly what would you do with a patient like this?
So we routinely give triplet prophylaxis for nausea, with all ADCs and with very good success. Our experience is now much better than it was 6-7 years ago. We see very, very little nausea. So that it contains, obviously, a steroid, it contains a 5-HT3 on danzigen or other drug, and an NK1 a drug. And with that, we go well. A second point to consider is because the drugs are around for a longer time, we actually have good activity with 5-HT3 on day 2 and day 3, which we would normally call delayed nausea. I call it delayed acute nausea because it's still a form of acute nausea where 5-HT3 works well. And then as you heard, olanzapine is a good alternative option that can be added. We had earlier discussion about what dose to give, whether to go in low with 2.5 milligrams or go more with a slightly more conventional dose. And of course, has to be considered that patients get quite tired with this. So we use relatively little olanzapine in our practice. We usually do quite well just with triplet prophylactics with slightly longer 5-HT3 application.
So Priyanka, I'm going to get your thoughts on this, but just to refer you to a really great article on QTI toxicity of TDXD that actually Javier is one of the authors in Future Oncology. Here's a table they have summarizing the data in terms of what's been seen. Priyanka, anything you want to add? Anything you want to say about do you use olanzapine? How do you use it? Also, what about the NEPA combination pill that's available? Is that more effective? What about this issue of long delayed nausea and vomiting beyond 5 days?
So we use the triplet therapy, as Peter said. Olanzapine, if it's indicated. One thing that I worry about olanzapine is when patients are nauseated, they don't eat and drink well, and you add olanzapine and they're more dizzy. So you just have to be cognizant of that. The other strategy that we used to use before we had these better drugs was Dex, right? You know, 3 to 5 days of Dex. You know, the side effects you have to live with. But it works well at low dose, 2 milligrams BID. And if the day 3, 4, 5 is more of a bother, you just kind of add the Dex to day 2, 3, 4, and 5.
All right, Javier, we'll continue this discussion. We have one more video if we can get to it. But I wanted you to go through some of the data concerning side effects of ADCs.
I think it's great, thanks. Because we have been discussing all my topics during this hour and a half, so maybe I would like to maybe give some take-home messages from some of the most common adverse events. Let me start with this table that summarizes the key adverse events of the drugs we have in the clinical practice. I have included also here cetuximab, irinotecan, and this comes from basically HR-positive, HER2-negative metastatic breast cancer, but it's just as an example. I think that with trastuzumab deruxtecan, gastrointestinal events, maybe neutropenia, without forgetting ILD pneumonitis, maybe with datopotamab deruxtecan, stomatitis and eye disorders, with cetuximab irinotecan, we were discussing about neutropenia and diarrhea, from SAC-TMT is a mix between maybe stomatitis and hematological adverse events, neutropenia and some anemia. So what is very clear is that these adverse events correlate with either the linker, the more unstable the linker is, the more chemotherapy-related adverse events we might expect. Also, based on the antibody-related issues, for example, the cardiotoxicity with T-DXd, and of course, the payload. So if we have to summarize the adverse events, that table, I like this table a lot, coming from Erika Hamilton, basically. And the point here, and that's one of my biggest comments, is that clearly antibody drug conjugate related toxicity is not always better than chemotherapy. So if you just think about some chemotherapeutic agents, for example, capecitabine, and you compare with some of the drugs we are discussing today, I think that the toxicity of CAPE usually is better or more convenient for many patients compared with many of the adverse events with antibody drug conjugates. Clearly, we have to differentiate between antibody-driven adverse events, the chemo or the payload-driven, and, of course, the antibody drug conjugate as a whole. So what about nausea and vomiting? We're discussing a lot about that. I would separate maybe three key types of nausea and vomiting. The anticipatory, and that's something that was very frequent before. It's not that frequent today with the prophylactic treatments we have in the clinic. Nevertheless, these are patients that when they go to the hospital, they start to have some nausea, and benzodiazepines or anxiolytics like lorazepam could be of great help to treat this nausea or this vomiting. The acute and the delayed. For the acute, and I would like maybe to summarize here the nausea and vomiting related to TDSD, but also might be very similar to other antibody drug conjugates, I would really recommend a triplet. There are some physicians that still recommend doublet. I think a triplet is better to prevent nausea and or vomiting. And we said before, with the corticosteroids, 5-HT3 receptor antagonists, ondansetron, palonosetron, whatever, and NK1 receptor antagonists. You were talking about a pill that combine netupitan and palonosetron. But at the end, is to combine these three strategies together. And we should not forget the delay nausea and vomiting that might happen also with TDXD. And here, olanzapine could be of great help. We were discussing before about the dose. We use the 5 milligram, but there are other physicians that prefer starting with a 2.5 milligrams a day. And we have escalated up to 10 milligrams a day. You can have some mouth dry, but in general, the toxicity is quite nicely with olanzapine. And what is very clear is that if you have significant toxicity, you can add olanzapine from the very beginning for the subsequent lines or subsequent cycles. And sometimes we administer the four drugs together to prevent subsequent nausea and or vomiting. What about neutropenia? Well, nothing new. I think that we all know how to treat neutropenia, but just maybe two key aspects here, at least for SG. We have considered patients with high risk of neutropenia, and these patients should receive prophylactic treatment with G-CSF. And second, about the reductions, we have a grade 4 neutropenia more than 7 days, or grade 3-4 febrile neutropenia. We should think about reducing the dose for one level. What about the diarrhea? Diarrhea, I will make a comment in a minute about preventive or to try to prevent diarrhea. But how to treat it? We should use always loperamide. If the diarrhea is not controlled with loperamide, we should start with two pills after the first diarrhea, and we can continue one pill every diarrhea, whatever you say in English, up to a maximum of 8 pills a day. But if this is not controlled with loperamide, we should think about atropine, for example. Sometimes there are not acute diarrhea that can be controlled with atropine.
How about cholesterol? By cholesterol.
Can be used as well, and it works. So what are the prime strategies? That was a study we conducted to try to prevent neutropenia and or diarrhea. And we basically gave to all patients loperamide prophylactically, 3 pills after the first dose and 3 pills after the second dose of SG, and 2 days of G-CSF after the first dose and 2 days after the second dose. And the primary objective was basically neutropenia and diarrhea the first 2 cycles. And what do you observe here? That grade 3 or 4 neutropenia was clearly decreased using GSF prophylactically. And also diarrhea was much better. How do these data compare with the arsenotropics? You can see here that any grade or neutropenia, any grade diarrhea, and of course grade 3 and grade 4 were clearly worse, were better when we gave these drugs prophylactically. What about left ventricular ejection fraction? Nothing new here. Don't forget to do a left ventricular ejection fraction assessment every 3 or 4 months when we use TDXD in the clinical practice. Of course, if this decreases a lot, we can or stop the treatment for a while or discontinue treatment permanently, depending on the final results of the left ventricular ejection fraction. ILD, we all know how to diagnose the ILD. Very important to recognize that some patients could have fever, and it does not mean that this is pneumonia. Some of the ILD events could develop fever as well. How to diagnose? So the majority of patients will have or asymptomatic or just few symptoms, which means grade 1 or grade 2. And very important to consider the risk factors. Dose, Japanese, and maybe other aspects could be increased. If we have a patient who received a drug that produced pneumonitis before, this, according to the label, should not be adequate to use a TDSD. Nevertheless, if we use it, we have to understand that this could increase the risk of ILD pneumonitis. Which is the time to have pneumonitis? The median time to onset is in the range of 5 to 6 months. And the number of ILD is in the range of 15% of patients with a TDSD, being grade 1 or grade 2, the great majority of them. You can see here the grade 2 is about 50%, grade 1 about 30%. What about the treatment of ILD pneumonitis? Always we should stop TDSD. If grade 1, we can start the TDSD again, and we can reduce or not depending on the time to recover the ILD grade 1. Grade 2, grade 3, 4, always stop the treatment permanently and use corticosteroids as soon as possible. What about stomatitis and mucositis? We have to recognize sometimes we have just the mucosa or the lips are redder compared than usual. Sometimes we might have some visible sores, and always it's common to have some mouth pain. So here you can see the grades, asymptomatic or mild symptoms, grade 1. So a little bit of ulceration or pain is grade 2. When we cannot drink or eat is grade 3. And grade 4, when we have to be internalized with severe consequences. This is very important. How to prevent stomatitis? We should use steroid-containing mouthwashes 3 to 4 times a day, 1 or 2 minutes each. And this is very important because if we develop stomatitis afterwards, grade 1, we can continue, but grade 2 is very important. If grade 2 was developed in patients who received prophylactic treatment, we have to reduce the dose afterwards. If grade 2 was developed in patients who did not receive prophylactic treatments, we can maintain the dose and try to avoid afterwards. So that's something important to take into account. Grade 3, always reduce the dose. Grade 4, discontinue the treatment. Finally, what about ocular or eye events, toxicity? So it's interesting to try to prevent. It's not easy, but try to prevent with eye drops. Second, to avoid contact lenses. And if needed, let's visit an ophthalmology. We can differentiate here between dry eye and keratitis, which basically is something that ophthalmologists know much more than us. But itching, some blurred vision is more dry eyes. We have ulcerations or eye pain is more keratitis. How to deal with these adverse events. Grade 1, continue with the same dose. Grade 2, continue with the same dose or decrease one dose level if it happens again. Grade 3, always reduce the dose. So finally, what can we do in the future to try to decrease the adverse events with some of these drugs? And this belongs not only to for the breast cancer field, but also for other tumor types. With some of them, we can do a dose capping. For example, with enfortumab vedotin, we should not go for more than 125 milligrams. We can also to cap the duration of the drug. Again, for some drugs like polatuzumab vedotin, so usually a maximum of 6 cycles should be used to prevent neurotoxicity. So sometimes we can start with a dose and reduce the dose after achieving a response. And another something that could be an approach is to try to separate or to decrease, to fraction the dosing to prevent toxicity. So that's something that has been employed in other tumor types, maybe in the future. For example, in the Demeter strategy in the HER2-positive field, we go for up to 6 cycles of T-DXd and we continue with the maintenance strategy. Something that could happen to reduce the dose.
Thanks so much, Javier. So yeah, and enfortumab vedotin, the ADC in bladder cancer and pembro, now first line because it beat cisplatin-based chemotherapy combination, talking about ADCs being more effective than traditional chemotherapy. Thanks so much to the docs who presented the cases here today. Thanks to faculty for attending. Thank you for coming. Come on back tomorrow night. We're going to talk about HER2-positive breast cancer.